Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
The journalist Michael Shearer has a profile of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in The Atlantic magazine. It's this month's cover story. And in it, Shearer says Kennedy told him his staff believed speaking with him was a mistake. As he points out in the piece, a lot of the favorable coverage of Kennedy had dried up years ago when he began his crusade against vaccines. His staff was probably right to be wary. But Shearer had this idea that somewhere in Kennedy's story he'd be able to work out what it is that's separating Americans these days. Kennedy was skeptical but sympathetic, and he agreed to participate. The two talked and texted through the fall, but they kept returning to the same arguments. And Shearer says he started to feel what he described as a growing sense of dismay about being able to establish basic factual common ground. And then he told us after Charlie Kirk was killed, Kennedy reached out and wanted to talk.
So at this point, I'd been working with him for a few months on this story. I'd traveled with him to Chicago when Kirk was killed. I'd traveled out to Colorado, actually, for another event where he'd attended. I'd interviewed him a couple times in his office. So we had a sort of rapport going at that point. And I mean, honestly, the shooting of Kirk was sort of like a shocking moment for both of us. And it was something we experienced together. And so he had asked to talk a couple days later about his thoughts about Kirk's killing. At the end of that conversation, I had sort of gone back to where a lot of our conversations went, to sort of challenging him on the science and what he was asking of me. Like, he was asking me to basically decide that all of his detractors and critics had no basis for their position. And so he asked for another Zoom, and I think it came at this emotionally elevated moment. And he went back to a sort of self-protection mode. You know, began it by saying that I think it was a mistake. We've been having this conversation, you know, the old story of the scorpion and the frog, where the scorpion asks the frog for help across the river. The frog says, no, I don't want to do it. You're a scorpion. You're going to sting me. The scorpion says, no, trust me. And then, of course, stings the frog. He was basically saying, it's that old story. You know, whenever I try and trust a reporter to work with them, you know, I end up losing from it. All the articles about me are the same. They're all ad hominem attacks. And then he kind of listed off all the conspiracy accusations against him, the claim that he's anti-science, that he's crazy, that he has a brain worm, moved a bear carcass or moved a whale carcass or ate a dog. I mean, all this stuff. And it was interesting because at that point, it was pretty clear that was not what I was doing. It was not the mission of the article to do anything ad hominem. The mission of the article, the mission of my time with him, was to try and understand where he was coming from and then create communication with the people who think what he's doing is incredibly dangerous for the country. It was clear he wanted the Zoom call as sort of evidence. It was almost like a tape in case I, you know, was lying all along and wrote a piece that really undermined him. He would have proof that he had told me he knew this was coming. Honestly, like, the bummer was that the stakes had been raised. I talk in the story about how my first reporting efforts with him were in 2023 when he's running for president. I'd written a story about him. He despised that story. We went back and forth a long time after that, arguing about whether I'd been fair to him or accurate in the story I maintained I had. And then I'd continued to talk to him, and I'd reported other stories with him, and we kind of rebuilt our relationship and met off the record. All of that was in the context of, like, let's understand this scientific debate. He wants to do certain things with vaccines. A lot of doctors and sort of the medical establishment says that'd be terrible, people will die. But there's not a lot of conversation there. So it's like, let's understand why he's doing this, where he's coming from. But the killing of Charlie Kirk, frankly, elevated that, because we were dealing in this sort of microcosm. The Kirk killing showed the consequences on a much greater scale of just how damaging this breakdown in communication had become. The idea that someone would feel it justified to murder someone else in cold blood for basically arguing ideas on a college campus is an example of a democratic society that's breaking down. It's not a functioning democratic society. And he saw it the same way I did, that this is a really bad moment, a foreboding moment. And rather than lead us to a place where we were working better with each other, at least for the moment, it made things much worse.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Michael Shearer is with us today. His story in The Atlantic is called "Why is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. So Convinced He's Right?" One of the things Kennedy told Shearer early on is that every article about him is the same. And that's where we began the conversation. I asked if Kennedy was actually right about that.
I think it's a little more complicated than that. It's certainly true that most of what's written about Kennedy falls into one of two buckets, for and against.
Yeah.
It's reporting about why the latest thing he did is really dangerous, or why the latest thing he did is really great and is going to lead to health improvements. Or it's reporting about why the latest thing he said is really crazy, or why the latest thing he said is really brave. And that is a function, I don't think, of a failure of our newspapers and national broadcast networks. That's a function of just how media is consumed and distributed these days. I mean, social media basically breaks up things into headlines and then feeds it to different audiences. And the algorithms are built to increase outrage. And I think he is very frustrated with that. And I share that frustration. I think the other thing that's important to say, though, is that Kennedy's politics and his approach to science and all this is intentionally antagonistic. His worldview is that people like me, journalists who work for respected media institutions in Washington, are part of the problem, and that I am like concealing the truth from Americans, and that I am basically a bad guy in the story, or people like me are bad guys in the story. Mm. I'm a boogeyman for him. Mm. And like, I wasn't trying to play into that, but I think he, you have to understand that he bears some responsibility for that, because his approach has been to media generally is like, is this going to help me or is this going to hurt me? And he's very distrusting, as I document in the story, of people who come to him and say, look, I'm not after trying to hurt you or help you. I'm after trying to describe what's happening, which was basically the pitch I made to him.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the rub of it. But he's very much a populist. I mean, his argument is the government, the medical establishment, the regulatory state, the media universe, the Democratic Party are conspiring to keep the truth from the American people in a way that is killing people. That's his argument. And so I was culpable in that. And that was sort of the premise of our relationship.
You also mention that you were interested in kind of exploring his story, his odyssey, as you put it, in a way to help you better understand what separates us. And also, as you say, you wanted to help narrow the political divide. Explain what you mean. Because that seems like a high aspiration for an article. Like you were trying to sort of work it out. And I don't know if that was informed by the Charlie Kirk moment. It sounds like it might have been in some way. But
like I said, it amped up to a new level with the Charlie Kirk moment.
Yeah.
But no, I think it preceded that. Okay. I mean, I wanted to. I mean, so just a little bit about me. Like I've worked at the Washington Post, Time Magazine. I now work at the Atlantic. I've worked at plenty of places before that. I've been in Washington since 2003. The political debate since 2003, when I got here, has pretty consistently deteriorated, and the relationship between people on different sides of the political divide had pretty consistently gotten worse. And I think that has continued even after Trump's last election. I mean, like, we are on a downward slide, and that's been the story of my career. And in that context, my job is to find out what's happening, tell people what's happening. I do accountability journalism. But I found, like, the thing that the country most needs is, you know, some greater understanding. I think you talk to a lot of political reporters who go out to Trump rallies and Kamala Harris rallies and talk to senior advisors on both sides of the campaign. You very quickly realize that everyone here is human, that everyone, almost most people, I mean, there's some rotten people in politics, But most people are not rotten people. They're not out to do harm to the country. Most people love the country. And so while there are real differences that are consequential, and they have to be fought out, and someone's going to win and someone's going to lose, it's also true that just increasing the understanding of what's happening and sort of like diffusing some of the just pure outrage, I'm going to fight harder, I'm going to dehumanize the other side more, is something of value. So that's constantly my motivation in a lot of the things I do. Not everything I do, but like that's constantly the motivation a lot of things I do. And that was a central premise of this. And a lot of my job generally is like talking to people and convincing them that I am not out to like drive the outrage meter. I'm out to understand things. If they've done something that's wrong and then I find out about it, yeah, maybe I'll drive the outrage meter. I mean, if Kennedy had said something that would have made people hate him more and it was newsworthy, I would have written it.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing I'll say is that like at the beginning of this process, and I told him this, my argument was Kennedy uniquely biographically symbolizes a lot of this decline. He's the child of, you know, the closest thing the United States has to royalty, the Kennedy family, the son of Bobby Kennedy, the attorney general and former presidential candidate who was assassinated. He, for decades, was, I think, someone anyone in the Republican Party now would call a far-left liberal, you know, crusading against corporate polluters and others, saying that George W. Bush was sort of turning the United States into a fascist country in the early 2000s because of his environmental policies. And now he was on the other side of that spectrum, totally embracing Donald Trump. And through all of that, he had become this sort of focal point of the country's rage. And that was because he was taking controversial positions on the political issue that literally is about whether kids live or die. I mean, like one of these political issues that like is as emotionally jarring as anything you can imagine. So that was also the sort of thesis of the story, that through his story, I could get closer to understanding the broader polarization.
Well, and you ask him how he explains that the arc of that story, you know, going from, you know, as you put it, scorned activist to the boss of the public health apparatus. And he gives you an answer in one word. He says, providential.
Well, I think literally he meant that I am trusting in the process. He's a deeply spiritual person. He's a religious person. I mean, the, you know, the literal meaning of that is, you know, God is doing this. Mm-hmm. I think more broadly, he is a recovering addict and is still a fundamental part of his life. He goes to recovery meetings every day. And letting go of the things you do not control is sort of the core thesis of alcohol and drug recovery. And so I think he lives his life through these rituals. He lives his life through a belief, and that his job, that he's mission-driven, that he's been put on this earth for a reason. And he just has to pursue those things. And if he pursues those things, good things will come as a result.
One of the things you mention is his susceptibility to this, you know, the grandeur of the Kennedy mystique and the sort of the mythology that comes with it. And I think it's interesting. You mention his choice of ties, like the way he dresses. And his ties are like his dad's. And in some ways, you can say that even though he's more muscle bound than his father, his suits are a bit like the way Americans saw Bobby Kennedy campaigning and working with his brother. So how does that Kennedy idea influence the way he thinks he should fit in the world and the way he thinks about all that?
When he was a child, he was reading the book Once and Future King about King Arthur, which is the story of young orphan King Arthur, doesn't know who his father is, pulls the sword from the stone, you know, runs through the woods with Merlin and figures out how magic works. His father gives him his first red-tailed hawk, and he names it after a character in that book. Now, when John F. Kennedy, his uncle, is killed, Jackie Kennedy gives an interview with Life magazine and quotes a Broadway play about Camelot. And so the idea that the Kennedy family was tied to King Arthur suddenly becomes this sort of public thing. And I think for young Bobby, the secretary, that just becomes the mythology of his life. He very quickly after his father's assassination falls into very heavy drug use.
Right.
But he is at that point quite literally the orphaned boy king who is in the woods raising hawks, feeding birds. And I think he always thought of himself as a sort of blessed person. I start the piece with a quote he wrote in a memoir he wrote about his family, in which he says, "I always thought from my youngest age that, you know, life was an epic battle between good and evil. And if we're lucky enough, we will be a part of that battle." That's not normal. I don't think most people go through their lives feeling like they're the heroic character slaying dragons, you know, from mythology in quite that way. And I think he does because of his life circumstance. And I think that explains his journey, why he's consistently embraced these ideas that are really on the edge of what's accepted.
Do you think you learned, or did you get a sense that his, that experience, those, you mentioned him drifting into addiction and, you know, self-destructive behavior after his father was killed. And it seems that the cause of environmental law, you know, becomes the, you know, the cause that helps him kind of rebuild his life. And I wonder, what are the common connections between those environmental crusades he was fighting then and the crusade he's fighting now about public health? I'm sure he sees them as the same fight, probably.
Yeah, I think they are the same fight. I mean, the kind of environmental activism he was involved with was very much based on the threat of contamination.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, you know, global warming or, you know, just preserve wilderness for the sake of wilderness. I mean, there are lots of environmental causes out there. But it was specifically pollution of waterways, starting with the Hudson River. These are corporate polluters who did things they shouldn't have done. He is coming out of addiction, is able to start a legal practice and be very successful early on in suing a lot of these polluters and creating a network of nonprofit groups that basically go around protecting waterways around the world from pollution. That introduced him to a world of trial lawyers who are doing that in other areas as well. I mean, he was a part of the like very large and successful litigation against the makers of Roundup. And while he's doing this work, people start showing up at his speaking events. I mean, one of the things he was very successful at as a trial attorney, when you're a trial attorney, you don't have to just argue things in front of a court. You have to find plaintiffs. You have to find people who've been victimized by whatever it is you're suing over, and they have to be the ones to sue. You have to have real injury to show before the court. And he was very effective at going around the country and recruiting large groups of plaintiffs to bring these suits. And so as he's giving these talks about environmental issues, people keep showing up and saying to him, well, if the thing you're not paying attention to is the damage being done by vaccines. Back then, the theory of the case, and I think this has been disproven, and although he disagrees, but there's been, and he's kind of moved away from this as like the sole theory, but the theory of the case is that there was a additive to vaccines called thimerosal, which was a derivative of mercury, and that was causing a bunch of chronic diseases, including autism in children. Thimerosal, 15, 20 years ago, stopped being included in almost all vaccines as a precautionary measure. There are a number of scientific studies, large studies, that have drawn the conclusion that thimerosal is not causing autism. He has stuck to this thesis even after thimerosal was taken up and kind of broadened it and said it's not just mercury in vaccines, it's aluminum additives in vaccines, it may be the vaccines themselves, it may be when they're given, the volume they're given with, but we just have to do more science to expose the damage that's being done now, and that became his cause. But through all of it, it's still contamination. It started contamination in the waterways, and now it's contamination in the medicine given to our children.
Michael Shearer He's a staff writer for The Atlantic. His story is called Why is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. So Convinced He's Right? It's the cover story for the January edition of the magazine. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Robert F. Kennedy Jr. In this month's Atlantic cover story, the journalist Michael Shearer sets out to understand how RFK Jr. went from environmental activist to MAGA insider. He spent months with Kennedy arguing about science, clashing over facts, and what emerges is a portrait of a man who's become a Rorschach test for American politics and who is absolutely convinced he's right. I want to ask what it's like to engage with or try to engage with Kennedy about facts and science and studies. One of the things you write in the article is you're drafting the piece. You started to feel this, as you described it, this growing dismay over your inability to, here's how you put it in the piece, establish even the basic factual common ground that scientific progress generally requires. So would you talk about this? It kind of gets at the question of what it's like to, you know, debate Kennedy or try to debate him and how he responds to the scientific studies that differ from the conclusions he's come to.
Yeah, Kennedy's incredibly well-read. And he loves reading scientific studies. He's not a scientist by training. He has no medical degree. But because of his litigation work, he became pretty accustomed to reading large volumes of the scientific literature. And so as a result, debating him on these topics, I mean, I'm a political reporter. I'm not a scientist. This isn't my area of expertise.
Yeah.
You know, he would tell me to read things. I would read them. I would call other scientists and ask, is this right? Why isn't it right? Explain this to me. I mean, at one point, he told me to call Pfizer, the drug giant, to ask them about one of their particular studies. And I did that. And the Pfizer people got on the phone with me, explained it, basically explained why Kennedy was wrong. I brought it back to him. He said, well, there still needs to be more studies here. And then we kind of debated from there. But the process of debating him is, I mean, it's exciting and interesting, but it's also a lot of work. The bottom line of this entire debate over vaccine science is that he believes there are potential harms that have not been ruled out by science. And because of that, he believes these vaccines should not be used in the way they're being used now. The scientific community believes that there's enormous benefits that have come from vaccines that have been well documented, that the most likely harms that could be caused by vaccines are monitored and have been tested for and been ruled out, and that you can't rule out every possible downside of any medication. You can just monitor for possible downsides and then respond. And so the debate becomes a subjective one about how much value to give to this doubt, this possibility that there's something out there that hasn't been discovered yet that could show a clear connection between a whole bunch of chronic diseases and vaccines, and that connection would prove the harm of vaccines is greater than the benefit of vaccines, which we know from other studies. But in the process of getting there, you end up going back and forth over all kinds of studies. And he's constantly looking in the scientific literature for areas of doubt, possibilities of doubt, you know, evidence that there's this one number that was hidden in one study that may have shown, you know, a danger that was not recognized by the study's authors, and that there may be a possible bias by the study's authors because they're funded by the drug company that's going to make money on the vaccine. And it just all goes down these like long rabbit holes. And, you know, what is interesting about Kennedy is he wants this conversation. He's desperate to have an audience like he ended up getting with me. And much of the sort of established scientific world has tried to engage with him and then decided it's worthless because they don't think he's operating in good faith. And so as a result, and this was one of the real frustrations of the story, there is right now no real dialogue going on between the country's foremost vaccine researchers, the people who developed these vaccines, who've led the regulatory structure up to now, and Kennedy and his camp of newly installed scientists who are shifting vaccine science. And where there is commonality, I think, is in the idea. I mean, Kennedy fully admits that he doesn't have the full proof to back up what he is saying.
Right.
What he has is evidence of doubt, like the possibility that what he is saying is true because it hasn't been disproven yet. And that's where the actual scientific debate ends up landing.
Well, you say you came to this realization writing the piece that the thing that he was doing, Kennedy, was making an argument that you, as you say in the article, that you hadn't previously understood, that he's making a policy claim, not a factual claim.
I say that in the context of one part of this vaccine argument, which is this question of whether there is real damage being done by the vaccines that are given in the first year of life
right.
to most kids when they're born. And his argument here is that we don't know the answer to that because the studies have not been done. And because the studies have not been done and we don't know the answer to that, it is irresponsible to recommend these vaccines. The counterargument from the vaccinologists who've put this schedule in place is we have ways of monitoring this, and the benefits are so enormous right now that even if what Kennedy is saying is true, you know, that there are a certain number of autism cases caused by these vaccines, for instance, the harm done would never be enough to compensate for the damage done. But the policy debate here is, you know, at one point Kennedy says to me, you do not give a medicine unless you know it is safe and effective. And that's kind of true in a way, but it's also true that that's not really the case. I mean, we give medicines all the time because we have studies that show they are effective against whatever the disease is or the cause, the thing they're trying to do. And we don't see evidence of harm that is greater. Yeah. We don't prevent those medicines from going on the market until we have tested every possible thing that could go wrong with them. And it's not infrequent or, you know, regular. With some regularity, there are medications that are approved by the FDA that are in circulation, that are used by tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Americans. They're later pulled off the market because those harms are only discovered later. But I was trying to work through in the story, you know, President Trump was democratically elected. Under our system, presidents get to choose the Secretary of Health and Human Service. Health and Human Service secretaries get to appoint committees within CDC, within FDA, and appoint scientists there, and they set health policy for the United States. And so the system does work in a way where the American people do have this indirect way of shaping what scientific policy is in the U.S. And so there is a legitimacy to that policy argument that Kennedy is making. Now, that is a separate question from whether it's good science or smart or whether it's going to kill more people than help over the long term. And I don't have an answer to that. I think no one has an answer to that. I think there are very good arguments that it may.
There's a point in your conversations with him that he says the whole medical establishment has huge stakes and equities that I'm now threatening, and I'm shocked President Trump lets me do it. So why do you think Donald Trump is letting him do it? And does Donald Trump understand what RFK Jr. means by make America healthy again? Are their interests, are their ideas really aligned there? How do you understand that relationship?
I think it's a surprisingly close and friendly relationship, especially since, you know, in early 2024, Kennedy was describing Trump as someone who appealed to the darkest aspects of, you know, the American psyche. He was, you know, a Democrat running for president against the Republican Party.
Yeah.
But I think for President Trump, he shares the skepticism that Kennedy has against established bureaucracy generally. Trump is very attracted to the idea, like Kennedy, that he could discover something that the, you know, powers that be have, you know, instituted on the American people and that is actually hurting them and then reverse that. I mean, we saw that with the whole Tylenol an autism connection spectacle that we saw last fall, where Kennedy basically came to Trump and said, look, there's these studies, they're not conclusive, they don't prove causality, but they suggest there may be a tie between Tylenol given to very young children or pregnant women and certain neurodevelopmental conditions. And so we should give some, you know, guidance, new guidance to doctors and to parents about Tylenol in the first years of life or during pregnancy. You know, Trump took that and really wanted to take it far beyond where the science was,
yeah,
and where even Kennedy wanted him to go with it. What Kennedy wanted him to do, which is what the FDA eventually did, was to just say, doctors should be cautious here, and you shouldn't take Tylenol unless you know you need it as a pregnant woman. And the reason for that is that Tylenol is really the only approved medicine for high fevers in pregnancy. And we know as a fact that high fevers in pregnancy can be enormously dangerous for the mother and the child. And so you don't want high fevers in pregnancy. So it's a very nuanced medical conclusion. And furthermore, we don't know that there's a causal link here. These are just observational studies, and there needs to be more science to prove the causal link. Trump took that and came out, you know, at the White House standing next to Kennedy and just, you know, translated into don't take Tylenol, do whatever you can not to take Tylenol, which was not the medical recommendation. But so I think Trump is attracted to a lot of that. And I think the last thing is Trump loves being associated with a Kennedy. For Trump, that's a great thing. I think he loves the degree to which this Make America Healthy Again movement has disrupted the sort of partisan politics. There are a certain number of liberal Democratic voters who are with Kennedy on this stuff.
Yeah.
And are sort of migrating away from the Democratic Party towards the Republican Party as a result.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. What it is you learned about the MAHA movement itself, and why so many Americans find Kennedy's message pretty compelling. I mean, if you set aside just for a moment, and we shouldn't forever, but just for the sake of argument, if you set aside the vaccine part for a second, how do you understand the MAHA movement? I mean, it's characterized as a mistrust in institutions, but there's this overlap with a broader wellness movement that's been growing for, you know, a good while now. There's the whole foods culture, the skepticism about, you know, processed foods, enthusiasm for like holistic wellness outside of mainstream medicine, you know, this opposition to larger institutions being talked down to by – I mean, it seems like there's a lot there. What do you understand about it and how Kennedy fits?
Yeah, so I think what you just described is right. There are a lot of ingredients that go into it. A lot of that is sort of coming together at a moment where there's enormous recognition within the American public that we are unhealthy. You know, I talk about in the story, you know, 100 years ago, infectious diseases were how we died. And today, very few people die from infectious diseases. The way you die is chronic diseases. You die from cancer, you die from heart disease, from diabetes. These are conditions where our body is not being attacked by a foreign organism or bacteria, but, you know, where our body is just not doing well because of what we're eating and how we're living. And I think there is this broader recognition in the country that we need to address that. Now, I think the thing that makes it jump to us the level that it's at now is the COVID pandemic, which was this national trauma that we all went through together that was painful for everyone. And our response to it was based on listening to medical authorities who were operating on what they thought was the best thing to do at the time without the time to actually do the science to know for sure what the best thing to do was. And so in retrospect, there's enormous distrust and anger at the medical establishment for some of the recommendations that happened. I think there's broad agreement that schools, for instance, were kept closed too long. Yeah. There's broad questioning over whether the masking and social distancing rules were necessary, at least in the way they were enforced. There's a huge debate in the country about whether the vaccine mandates, as opposed to just having the vaccine available to people, but mandating people, even who didn't want to take the vaccine, they have to take the vaccine to be a part of society, to come to work, to go to school, were a good idea. And Kennedy has told me at times, like, basically that. He could not have run for president in 2024 if not for COVID. The vaccine issues that he had been focused on just blew up during COVID and created the ingredients for a real political movement. And then I think the genius thing that happened in 2024 was merging that COVID vaccine anger at the medical establishment with what the medical establishment had already embraced by that point, this idea that we need to change the foods we eat, mm-hmm. we need to change the way we're living, we need to actually become a healthier society. And that's really what we should focus on if we want to reduce medical costs. Merging those two things made it into what it is today.
The idea, it's often called anti-science, and Kennedy himself, he mentioned, he said, you know, he has this belief that people should go do your own research. And it seems like there's this sort of epistemology that he's talking about that seems appealing to a lot of Americans where, you know, personal experience or your own kind of intuition should go alongside or in some cases, you know, in place of institutional science. Are you seeing something like that in all of this?
What I asked him was, look, you're saying everybody, like he has a line that he repeats often where he says, you shouldn't trust the experts.
Yeah.
Trusting the experts is like a step on the path to tyranny. That's not what democracies do. We make decisions for ourselves. And my response to him was, well, you now are pretending to be the expert. I mean, he's literally making policy in some cases by his own personal fiat. I mean, he doesn't through other people that changes health recommendations. He's not a doctor that affect everyone. And he's doing it on his own interpretation of the science and what he's reading. And his answer to that was, don't trust me. I'm not asking people to trust me. I'm saying people should not trust me. They should do their own work. They should read these papers. They should struggle with it themselves. And then the conversation goes on with me saying, well, wait a minute. If my car breaks and I need a new muffler, I don't like go to the library and buy a book on how to replace mufflers in my car. I take it to a mechanic. I'm trusting an expert. Everything I do during the day, I mean, I don't understand how the electricity works in my house or how to build a Wi-Fi router or anything like that. Like, I trust experts as a rule to drive the metro train that gets me to work. And his response to that is, well, yeah, but if you're going to a mechanic, you at least shop around. You at least ask your friends, is that a good mechanic? You check the Yelp reviews. And so there's this like ongoing conversation we had there about, it wasn't really about whether you trust experts or not trust experts, but it's sort of where you turn the dial of skepticism and how far you should turn it away from trusting authority and how much you should trust authority and how much you should apply yourself, feel a personal responsibility to understand things before you commit to them.
Michael Shearer. We're talking about his Atlantic profile of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. It's called Why is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. So Convinced He's Right? We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist Michael Shearer. We're talking about his cover story in the Atlantic magazine. It's called Why is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. So Convinced He's Right? Jay Bhattacharya, you talk to him. He's sort of a kindred spirit with RFK Jr. these days. He's now the NIH director at HHS. And, you know, he clashed with colleagues at Stanford over his views about the pandemic. And one of the things that he said to you is that Robert Kennedy Jr. changes his mind if you give him the evidence. Is that right?
I think that's a complicated question to answer cleanly. I mean, there was a point, I don't think it's in the story, where I asked Kennedy, you know, what is the one thing your detractors don't like most misunderstand about you? And his answer was, well, that I listen to people and then I change my mind. That has not meant that he's willing to change his mind about these big things. And I think he is very skeptical about who he listens to. So he's narrowed his circle of advisors to people who more or less already agree with him on the big issues to begin with. I think Jay is an interesting case because Jay, you know, made common cause with Kennedy during the COVID pandemic because he signed on to a criticism of how COVID policy was being handled. Basically, he argued that you shouldn't do social distancing for the entire population with this virus. There should be social distancing just for people who are likely to be seriously ill or to die, the elderly, people who already have illnesses. And then other people should be allowed to circulate, should be allowed to get the virus because the harm will come down. It was a legitimate argument at the time. It was met with enormous backlash at the time. You know, Kennedy saw that backlash and drew close to Jay as a result. That doesn't mean they have the same view on vaccines, I don't think. And you know, one of the examples that Jay told me about was during the measles outbreak early in Trump's term in Texas, you know, Jay had been one of several people who implored Kennedy to mention that the measles vaccine is, you know, in a very effective way of preventing your child from getting measles. A lot of the people who have been getting measles in that outbreak and other outbreaks were never vaccinated. And so Kennedy started to include language along those lines in his statements. He wasn't recommending it explicitly. He was saying parents should make their own decisions, but you should know that, you know, a measles vaccine is actually effective at preventing your kids from getting measles. And so that was one of those examples. You know, for a number of people in public health, that still wasn't enough because he was leaving open all these holes. And, you know, Kennedy said other things about the measles vaccine that were discouraging people to take from it. So it became very complicated. But I do think one thing Kennedy is not is intellectually incurious. I mean, he does want to consume information. He does want to have the debate. The problem is that the debate has broken. And I think he has some responsibility for the debate having broken.
Maybe it's too early to tell this, but I'm wondering, Michael, let me ask this carefully. How much damage or what difference has he made to public health? You know, how much work is it going to take to, if you have to, rebuild the material and intellectual infrastructure of public health, a system that Kennedy's trying to reshape? Like, do you think it's too early to say? Or what do you think so far?
I think it's been enormous. And it's not just Kennedy, it's the Trump administration. You know, since Trump took office, the number of employees of the Health and Human Services Department has been reduced by about a fourth. There have been proposals to cut the research funding at NIH by 40%. What ends up, you know, being put in place may be different than that. But it's just been a massive reimagining and shrinking of the public health infrastructure. And, you know, I think it'll take time to know how that's going to manifest. Some of that maybe was duplicative, didn't matter much, but it's going to take some time. At the same time, we've had a clear reduction in voluntary vaccination rates. It's a few percentage points. It's not massive. But if you're trying to create herd immunity at some point, it can become very consequential, even if it's a few percentage points. And I think the expectation is parents choosing not to vaccinate their children will increase. A number of states, sort of inspired by Kennedy and his rhetoric, like Florida, have started relooking at whether there should be vaccine mandates for enrolling in school. That's a huge experiment. I mean, that almost certainly will lead to outbreaks, you know, 5-10 years from now, and we'll see what happens from that. It's also true that I think the American people are thinking about food differently because of Kennedy. I watched the football games, the NFL playoffs last weekend.
Yeah.
And I was struck by how many of these companies now, like Starbucks and Chipotle, are advertising protein shakes and protein cups. And that has a lot to do with Kennedy. Kennedy flipped the food pyramid, basically saying to people, stop eating sugar, stop eating processed carbohydrates, focus on protein and vegetables. And so these companies like Starbucks that basically are in the business of selling sugar drinks with some coffee in them to the American people that are not healthy for them are quickly trying to, you know, figure out how to handle it. A lot of states, starting with conservative states, have changed how they give out benefits for food, requiring that, you know, basically preventing people who are on food assistance from using that government money to buy sugary sodas and other things we know are not healthy for people. And that's a huge shift. You know, I remember just a decade ago, Mayor Bloomberg in New York was railing against big gulps. And conservatives were furious at how dare, you know, the liberal big city people tell us we can't have our, you know, 20-ounce sodas. And now this is a conservative cause. This is the far right. You know, these are red states saying to their people, look, if you buy that 32-ounce Coca-Cola thing, you're probably hurting yourself and your kids. And we don't want the government to be a part of helping that happen. And so I think it is a pretty, like, it's hard to understate how dramatic this shift is. I mean, and those are just, I've just mentioned there three or four things. I mean, he's remade the vaccine schedule. It's not clear how people are going to respond to that. And when you remake the vaccine recommendation schedule, you're not preventing anyone from giving vaccines to their kids. I think most doctors or many pediatricians are still going to recommend to people to vaccinate their kids along the lines of the old schedule. So we don't know exactly how that's going to affect things. He's decided he's going to fund whole other areas of research, which is going to take money away from other areas, and that will have effects. But so I think it's enormous. I don't know, you know, in the final count, say 20 years from now, you know, what the cost or benefit will be net. And I don't know. I mean, even then, we may not know. That's a really complicated question to understand. I think you will be able to tell 10 or 20 years ago from now, you know, what did it mean to not give the hepatitis B vaccine at birth as a standard procedure? How many more kids grow up to have liver failure as a result? And how many fewer kids grow up to have other chronic diseases that Kennedy suspects may be caused by the hepatitis B vaccine at such a young age, but that we don't know is caused by that vaccine? So those are all questions that may be answerable, but it's going to take some time to figure out.
Let me ask you finally, did you end up close to what you were hoping for in trying to understand what separates us? And did it at all give you a sense of how to narrow the political divide? Did that aspiration that you sort of went after, did any of that work for you, do you think?
I think I showed my work. So I don't think this story solves anything. Like, it's not like I discovered the secret scroll that is going to solve, you know, heal the country. Yeah. But I showed the process we went through. You know, I ended it on pretty, you know, we started this interview talking about him accusing me of, you know, double crossing him and betraying him. You know, Kenny and I ended this process on pretty good terms. You know, I don't, like, he was not surprised or appalled by anything in the story. It's not a story he's been bragging about. I mean, he hasn't been going around telling people that they have to read this story. But I think, like, on that interpersonal level, he recognized what I wrote as being what happened and as being accurate and as fairly representing his views and representing the views of his opponents. And so in that way, there was a conversation had here. But it doesn't solve anything. I mean, this is not like there was no resolution. It's not like there's a new path forward on vaccine science that suddenly everyone agrees on. I think, you know, if there is a benefit from this sort of a story, it was showing the intent in the process. And I do think that intent and process in hundreds of other ways, like outside of, you know, medical debates, in politics, is sort of what's going to help this country if we sort of pull ourselves out of the descent we're on right now. Like, you know, in the absence of an economic boom that suddenly takes away all our problems, I do think ultimately we have a couple decisions here. We either try and understand each other better and try and talk to people we disagree with and identify with people we disagree with and empathize with them, or we hate each other more and more and more until the social fabric kind of falls apart. And that's, I think, a real thing. I mean, it's not a thing that's going to happen next year or in 2 years, but anybody who watches the news, I think, in this country can kind of feel it in their bones that something's getting worse here. So I wouldn't say it's a total success, no. But I do feel like it was an effort worth undertaking.
Michael Shearer, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Michael Shearer, he's a staff writer at The Atlantic. His January feature is called "Why Is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. So Convinced He's Right?" We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on YouTube at KUER 90.1, on Instagram at Radio West. You can also email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our social media intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.